Okay. So I'm just gonna pretend what we have so far for the for a project we're doing that is called energy efficient hybrid memory. A little motivation first. So this is basically trying to save power in machines, could be servers or even embedded systems. The first thing is that servers today consume 10 times more energy or power than 10 years ago. Now high-performance servers consume an estimate of 300 watts per year, with the same $330. So if you have a farm, then you could consume a lot of power. The other thing is that IBM researchers have reported that memory consumption of these kind of machines range from 19 to 41% of the total power consumption of these machines.
So what does 300 watt per year mean?
I don't know exactly.
Watt is already per unit of time, right?
It's per second.
So watt per year.
Yeah, I guess it's watt hour, right?
Oh, watt hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now that I think about it, probably watt hour.
Yeah.
No, 300 seems a little for watt hour.
Probably
300 watts per second, or that equivalents to 330 per year.
Per second.
No, 300 watts, if you say it's already per second, right?
Yeah.
I can look for a source.
So that's what I'm saying. It's just, that is the same as 330 per year.
Yeah. I don't think it's 300 watts of power that these servers are, servers can consume.
It can consume. Yeah, and more than that. Yeah. I mean, some one unit machines that we use with one CPU use 250.
And it says high performance, so I'm guessing.
Yeah,
a lot. Yeah, it says 300 watts. Okay. You say 1 hour, so probably.
So that is probably 300 watts, that's equivalent to
330 per year.
Yeah.
So it's not per year 300 watts.
Yeah. Okay. Just a brief description of the device that I'm involved in this project. So the first one is that the RAM based on this DDR3 with the RAM, 8 gigabytes of RAM consume 8 watts in active, 6.9 watts in idle, and costs approximately $320. So in the case of the flash, you can have 32 gigs, which is 4 times more capacity. In the active case, you have 2.4 watts, which is a lot less than the RAM. In the case of the idle, you have even less. And the price is competitive. So what we propose is a new hybrid architecture that combines a small amount of high-cost energy-inefficient RAM that is backed by an energy-efficient flash-based storage.
So in the cost you've shown in the last slide, is cost of the, it's not cost of the watt, it's, I think it's cost of the RAM.
Of the hardware.
Hardware plus?
Yeah.
Or
no. The energy is not. It's not. Yeah. And I guess. Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay. So we have these observations that we think for now we think are happening in a real workload. That's why it's this to do. The idea is that we have first some spatial locality. We want some hot data to be located in small regions of memory. The non-uniform access, we want non-uniform access distribution with large amount of cold data. So we want a small amount of hot data that is accessed all the time. And parts of it we bought. And we also want low residual memory access required by disk call data. And basically what we want is that disk call data, or the bandwidth required to serve disk call data, is less or equal than the bandwidth that the SSD can give. So we keep this hot data in this small hot data in RAM and the rest in the SSD.
So one question is that, are you able to access the SSD in units of words?
Actually, you can't because of the
design, right?
Because of the interface, right? So you can access in terms of 512 blocks usually. But our plan is to do this at the page RAM, which is 4K. Okay? That's why we want. That's one of the reasons
that's
we want to
go
spatial
locality.
Exactly.
Important.
Yeah. Okay, so a little overview of the system. So first of all, we want to this hybrid memory to use demand paging and page replacement as a normal system, right? A normal virtual memory system. So I guess probably the most important difference and the one that is most challenging is that any page in the system, including using an user and also kernel, will reside in the flash or RAM. So usually in a normal virtual memory system, the only pages that are backed by the swap are the what are called the anonymous pages, which are those pages that are not executable. In the case of the executable, they are backed by the executable file. But these pages, like a heap and the stack, which don't have a file, right? They are back in the swap. So in our case, we want the kernel pages, the anonymous pages, and I guess one important part of these kernel pages to be in the SSD, right? So in this case, I guess the page cache is really important. If we don't feed the page cache in the SSD, then we could have some performance problems. Right?
Yeah, I still think you should sell this and improve
swap. Yeah, that's what I was
saying.
So improve swap.
Yeah, instead of saying hybrid memory, it's just swap.
So basically, you're just adding more memory, and it's like an intermediate step between the swap or and the RAM. I mean, those are exclusive, right?
No.
Or you could have things duplicated.
Yes. In fact, you can have dirty pages in the SSD. Okay. So if you write a page in the
SSD and in the memory, you can have dirty pages.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mean dirty pages in the SSD means that are more updated in the SSD and are not updated in the RAM? Something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. You can have situations where you have, let's say, a page of the page cache in the SSD and not in the RAM, and it's dirty.
So
which is somewhat different to a swap, right?
Yeah.
So that's
so,
why
so,
cannot
so why did you prefer to have multiple copies of the page?
Prefer to have multiple.
Yeah, because you said the caches are not exclusive. I mean, wouldn't that complicate your design, having multiple copies instead of just one copy?
So what you're saying, what you're trying to compare is a system where we have the flash as a cache of the RAM.
Yeah, something like that. No, that's the other way around. Like that, it's a, like a cold cache or something like that.
Cold
you have the RAM, what you use a lot, and then on the. Well, I don't know what are your goals for. Probably.
So my question is: what happens when a program tries to access a page, and then the page is not in the memory, RAM?
Okay, and should that page is a file or is an anonymous page? Like a
should I go to the question?
No, look. Let me see. Okay, the thing is that there are some scenarios, right? So, in the case you are trying to access a file which has not been accessed before, then you need to bring that page into RAM to be accessed.
Just like
okay. Yeah, so probably you do some modifications to that page, and in the normal case, you have pdflush flushing those pages to the disk,
uh-huh.
right? But now we can that page cache page is pageable to the flash, right?
I think if you bring up the state diagram, because
yeah, I don't have the state diagram here.
Oh, you don't have. Okay. But maybe you have it in the paper. You can just pull that and.
Yeah, but I don't have the paper in this laptop. I can draw it.
I mean, so the point is that I think what's not clear is that what goes into flash and what goes into RAM.
Exactly.
I think that
the thing is that in the flash goes everything, all the pages you can have.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is also different from normal flash. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is that you keep the hot data in the RAM so that you don't go into page fault.
So I guess when a page is brought into memory from the disk, it first goes into memory and then you make a copy of that into the swap.
No, I don't do a copy.
So instead of,
it is necessary.
So instead of using a swap, you're using an SSD.
Instead of using a swap, I'm using an SSD. What do you mean by that?
I think what you said. So
mm-hmm.
So basically, you're not going to be writing to the disk, but you're going to be writing to the flash.
Not always. I mean, the idea is that. Let me see.
I don't know how to explain it.
So, the thing is that the flash will be like an extension of a RAM, right? Will be like a slow RAM.
But
memory.
So.
Exactly. That's
no, memory. Because in the normal memory, you only have anonymous pages.
No, but again, the thing about the anonymous page, I mean, the ideal definition of swap is that anything can go into the swap.
Yeah,
but it's implemented that way because it's easier or because there's something else we don't know. But the ideal original definition of swapping, I'm sure it was that everything can go to the swap.
Any
type of.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's the most logical thing. To
yeah.
Happen, right?
No, it's not the most logical thing to happen. I think the swap, by definition, is that you have.
I'm not sure this, but the definition
yeah.
of swap really.
Okay.
No, but I think Ricardo is right. I mean, swap originally was for everything. Now they improved it so that you can only put this and this other type of thing.
No, the thing is that actually it's easier to have. Actually, I don't think there was such a thing as you put everything in the swap.
Yeah.
So
why didn't that happen?
Because
we are seeing that it's actually better to read that.
Yeah, because the thing is that if you think about an executable, let's say, you load that the code of the executable in memory, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Putting that executable in swap doesn't make any sense because you're going to put it down in the disk again. So why would you do that if you have the executable in the file system anyway?
Well, no, I think we will put the executable.
Okay, so what you're saying is that
no, right?
Because
of duplicate. So what you're saying is that because of duplicated content on disk, that's why people didn't do it in the past. Most likely, right?
It doesn't make sense.
On those days, actually, they were having a lot of used stuff on disk, but not as normal as now. Now disk is so cheap that we don't care to have many copies, right? So what we're really proposing is a new form of swap where we are actually.
Yeah, but the thing is that this swap is
save duplicated content on secondary storage.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, in terms of, maybe I can clarify something. You're right. I mean, swap allows you to use the disk as a backing store for memory pages, and the optimization is that because there already exists a copy elsewhere in the file system, there is no reason to write it out to the swap.
Yes.
Right. Especially if you make no modifications, you save a write operation.
Yeah.
So that's an optimization, perhaps, of an original swap design, if there was one. that stored everything in the swap partition.
Yeah.
Correct. And no one knows what the original design of swap was. We could go back to I don't know, Denning's virtual memory paper and find out what exactly they proposed. And I think it goes back even before Denning, right? And 1960s, early 60s or something. And at that point, they had some design, right? So the optimization is that because the data already exists, there is no reason to do those write operations. Let's not write them to the swap.
Yes.
In this paper, we have to clarify what the difference between this system is with the current state of swap, right? Current state of virtual memory systems. And therefore, we bring up these differences. But in principle, the idea is the same, which is that we have a backing store for memory. Mm-hmm. And it's the other difference is that we are using a different device than the original disk-based swap. The third difference, which I think is where things get interesting, is how do you manage this device, which is a new device with very different characteristics, so that you get the best performance, so that you address bare leveling. Right? I think that's where the real contributions of the
And I think there's also another difference that this is non-exclusive. You have repeated pages. You have repeated content here and in memory, right? That's what I understand.
Right, but you can have also in the normal swap
as well. I mean, if you have to evict or if you bring in a page and you don't dirty it, then there is a copy on swap.
Right.
You don't reuse the slot in the swap. It does exist.
Oh, but that's not what I understood. Okay. No, what I understood is that...
I'm talking about the original swap. I'm saying that there is duplication there as well.
Because you don't evict the page.
No, so you when you do demand paging,
mm-hmm.
you read from the swap.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you have it in memory and the swap.
Mm-hmm. And if you modify in memory, that's what you're saying.
If you modify in memory...
Yeah, but you can mark it as, after you load it, you mark it as free in the swap.
You could mark it as free in the swap. And
I mean, it will still be there, of course, because it's a persistent medium, but...
Yeah, so in this case, we also mark it as free. The same thing. But there is a copy on flash. I guess maybe we should go into the...
Yeah, and the thing is that the swap is not a cache to memory either, so it's not a problem to be exclusive or not.
Caches can be exclusive.
Yeah,
but... Okay, that's true. But...
I mean, my point is really that it shouldn't matter how we call it.
Okay.
But even us, that we are a little bit more open-minded than the typical system guy. Even for us, it's a bit. I mean, I cannot accept this to be called non-swap. It's a swap.
Yeah.
So we it's should be.
So it's a special
swapping
device, right?
Well, yeah. I don't agree, because if we call it a swap, then people will say that you follow the design of current swap system, but we don't, right? We make some different choices. I mean, whether we call it a swap or not, we have to clarify those distinctions. What are the differences? And as long as we do that, as long as we clear what we do, it's sufficient. And then, then some people might say, okay, why don't you call it a swap? Then, well, we don't call it a swap because not the same as current swap system.
So,
these
more like a new step to between the gap of high-performance memory and hard disk. So by having this architecture, then you're going to move data from the memory to this flash device and then to the disk, which is going to be faster than this, depending on the kind of operation that you're going to run on it. So that's exactly what you guys are doing, what you guys have proposed.
That will, eventually that will be the consequence of what we are doing. But our goal is to run the system with less amount of memory. Because memory consumes power, and the amount of power that memory consumes is directly proportional to the size of the memory. So if you're able to run...
So that's why your spatial locality of data is important.
Yes.
I mean, if there is no locality, there is no use of...
Correct.
Exactly. Less memory, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the observation that we want to make with these memory traces that we are trying to collect is that there is locality, and there is a smaller working set than the full size of DRAM that processes typically will need to function at the best.
So even if let's say OLTP process, or something, OLTP benchmark is running, the memory actually is consumed, it's actually less than what it requires. The locality of, I mean, it always accesses a specific portion of the memory.
Yeah, so I guess another way to think about it is that a large amount of memory we are contending is occupied by the page cache. Okay, and the reason the page cache exists is because by storing all those file pages in memory, we are speeding up access to the file system, okay, which is on disk.
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't exist, then we had to go to disk each time. Now what we are saying is that the page cache plus some other cold data which are not accessed very frequently, let's put it in the flash instead of, and thereby allow the system to run with a much lesser amount of memory,
mm-hmm.
right? But the penalty of page faults now is not as great as before, because the random read performance characteristics of flash is much, much better than reading from disk. It is two orders of magnitude better.
So even if that page in normal case has to read from per page, it takes a large amount of time.
Right.
In normal flash.
Right.
But in flash, it's a lot faster.
Yeah. So the argument is that you can perhaps get the same amount of performance by providing a large amount of flash memory to store all the cold data that the programs may access over a longer period of time, which otherwise they might have to access from disk, and now you can probably store have a much bigger page cache than before, because flash is cheaper per byte of storage than DRAM. So that's the goal, which is to run the system off of much smaller amount of DRAM so we can save power.
So if you take like the current, any current system like Linux, and you tell it to put the swap partition in a flash-based drive, this will outperform that, right?
So if we take the current swap implementation
uh-huh.
as is and use the flash,
mm-hmm.
the page cache misses will still go to disk. That's the real problem.
Why?
Because
those will just get addicted.
Yeah, those will, if you run, I'm comparing the same configuration, which is the same amount of memory,
okay,
with a swap configured to use a flash,
okay,
right, versus this hybrid memory system, then page cache evictions will go to disk. And that's how it works, because virtual memory does not manage the file system page cache.
Mm-hmm.
So those page cache pages are not swappable, executable pages are not swappable, so they will go to disk, faults will have to be retrieved from disk, and so just mapping current swap solutions to a flash does not provide the same kind of advantages that this design provides. It's just because of maybe optimizations that people have been making with swap that screws up everything, but that's the current state of the art, right? Is that if you use a swap backed by a flash, then you don't get the same kind of access characteristics that you get with this system.
So even doing that, you should not have set up in person, and you're shaking, right?
Probably, yeah, I guess so. If there will be some improvement. But there will be still accesses that might have been able to serve from the flash that would go to disk.
Because normally we don't store page cache in the swap.
Right.
And the other thing too is, I mean, probably on servers they still will not do that, but like the fully SSD drive, the solid state drive, I mean, once that happens, everything will be on flash. So, I mean, that's something else to consider, right?
Sure, yeah. And I mean, if you're talking about complete replacement of disk with SSD,
mm-hmm.
then we have to reevaluate this.
Oh.
Maybe you can use another higher performance flash storage for swap than what you're using for your file storage.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption is that complete replacement is at least not in the near future.
Yeah.
So we'll still be using disk drives for the time to come.
So we're gone.
No.
Okay, so, well, there's a list of challenges. So the first one is that it's, of course, the difference with the performance between the memory and the SSD, right? So it's part of it, so it's like
So SSD is 12,000 and memory is 200.
Yeah, so this is the best case. Comparing SSD and sequential read. Right? So there is also a large performance variability in the SSD itself, ranging from 250 megabytes for sequential read to 30 megabytes per second for random writes. Another thing is that now we'll have also a higher page fault rate because we're reducing the memory size. So we have a higher page fault rate compared to traditional virtual memory. So we need to handle the page faults or reduce as much as we can the amount of time we spend in handling the page fault. And there are also some problems related to the device we're using, the new device we're using, which of course the most problematic is wear leveling, apart from the performance that I already mentioned. That is, if we write a block, the same block multiple times, say 100,000 times is more or less the number, then we break the at least we cannot use that block anymore. So we need to be careful on that. So.
Go ahead.
No, I don't have a question.
Sorry.
Okay.
So
the one for self count is faster.
No, it's megabytes per second.
So you mean SMT is much faster than memory?
No, finished memory and this is
MB.
Yeah, MB is megabytes.
No. The thing is that you put SSD and memory, and then you compare it in the other way. That's why I was also confused.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So instead of inverse. But I guess the point is that another point that is important there is that
it's two orders of magnitude.
Yeah, it's two orders of magnitude. And also, this is when you're accessing memory continuously. So if you're accessing memory at each clock cycle, then you will get 12,800 megabytes per second. So the question is, what do real workloads really consume? I mean, how much memory bandwidth do they really consume? Do they consume 12,800 megabytes per second or not?
Okay.
And I guess the real question is that if we refactor all the hot data into memory, what is the bandwidth requirement for the cold data?
Mm-hmm.
As long as that bandwidth requirement is below 250 megabytes per second, then we are still okay to run the cold data off of the flash.
So I guess then something important here is that this would be what you're saying is that if in each this would be I mean the 12,000 megabytes per second would be if you access the memory each cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each cycle. You talk
about frequency of the system bus, right? Because it has a different frequency of the processor.
Yeah, memory bus.
Memory bus.
Yeah.
Frequency of memory bus. That's right.
Okay.
So the question is that's the bandwidth that's available in DDR3, it's DRAM, but how much do applications can really use of that 12,000 megabytes per second?
Awesome. Okay. So welcome design remarks. So I guess first we have the goals. The goals of the system itself. So first of all, it has to be application agnostic, meaning that the application doesn't need to know what is going on underneath. The second thing is a full memory virtualization, meaning that any type of page, any user or kernel page needs to be virtualized in this way. The other thing is that we want to have a high performance, meaning that we don't want to the performance we get at the end with this system should be at least the same performance that we had before with the RAM alone. And the other role is about durability and the wear leveling of the flash.
Mm-hmm.
So I just about comment about the high performance.
Sure.
Or the performance is not, we are not aiming for performance at least as good as RAM or HDD, because that's the best case performance.
Right.
Best case performance is as good as just using RAM.
Right.
In the average case, we want the performance to be not substantially lower than the performance of RAM. That's really what we're going after. Or it's okay to say, I guess, indistinguishable from RAM only. As a goal, which is virtually indistinguishable. It could be worse performance than RAM only, but it's not too worse, and therefore it is indistinguishable.
Okay.
So these are small diagrams. Sorry, it's much deeper. Oh, no, let's talk about this. This is a small diagram, I guess, of the flow of the system. So the idea is that you have the applications which generate page faults, and these solid rectangles are foreground operations, that is, foreground operations which are seen by the application. So we have the demand paging, and then we need to bring the page, generate the page fault, and then we have the data replacement, which we need to replace some page if there is no free space. In the background, we have these two components. The first one is the page ranking. We're going to talk about the page ranking in detail. And we have then a flushing space allocation, which is a thread that is constantly running and flushing some pages that will be likely to be replaced in the future. So we want to reduce the page fault time that we account when a page fault occurs.
Just to add something here, I think the goal is to, when there is a page fault, you always have a free frame available.
Right.
Right. So to achieve that constraint, that is always have free frame, in the background you need to create those free frames.
Right.
Continuously. So you always have, let's say, a minimum number of free frames that available in the system. So if there is a cascade of page faults, the worst case cascade of page faults can still be absorbed by those free frames that are available. So the goal of these background components is just to ensure that there is a available minimum amount of free frames in the system,
right,
at any moment.
So it's something like that on the page test.
What?
On the page test?
Isn't it
something like that? Same mechanism.
PD flush?
I don't remember the name, but there is the same mechanism.
PD flush.
There is always a page.
There is always some space.
Isn't
yeah,
it that Java of an operating system itself to keep some free frames? Even in normal system, even forget about with all the fancy things, I mean, just the operating system's job is to keep some free frames. I mean, whenever there is a page fault, so that it can load
right.
something from
so, this. So the goal, how do you create free frames? Yes, it is the job of the operating system to make sure that free frames are there, but the question is, how do you create those free frames? You create those free frames because the virtual memory system is having some sort of rank list. We are doing very similar things to what the virtual memory system is
okay.
doing. And therefore, you see the repetition here, right? The same ideas here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, I think this is the case. Candidate, just in case I need more RAM. So you are lacking.
Right. I think the virtual memory system probably does similar ranking, right? It has to, because it needs to replace the, or flush out the pages that are the least important to retain.
Right.
Yeah, you can use the large.
Okay. So I want to talk about page ranking and replacement. So the first thing is that our page ranking is based on how successful it is to do a replacement or not. So of course we take those, we want to replace those pages that minimize the replacement cost. So anyway, so the first thing is that if you forget about this, the cost of replacing a page will be the time of reading, the time of reading the page you're bringing in memory, and the time to write the page that we're replacing.
What's DI?
What's that?
DI.
Page height.
No, DI.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
So DI is the page dirty or not? Because you're not gonna write always to the flash, right? If the page is clean, then you only need to read the page you're bringing to memory and replace the page that you're replacing. So this also has, all these costs need to have a factor in how popular is that page in the work of the trying right now. So we weight all that cost by the rank of that page, the page that we are replacing. There are some details on the time of reading and the time of writing. The time of writing usually in the flash is hard to predict. So I think we need to work out some details. Right. Okay, so I guess we already discussed this. So the idea that the system caches the top end pages to flash periodically, so we increase the write chance when a fault occurs. So we want to minimize the page fault time or the page fault handling time. So if we eliminate, if we make this zero, then we are less likely or we minimize time to do the page fault.
What do you mean by top 10 pages?
I mean that the pages that are more likely to be replaced in a page fault, or will be selected to be replaced in a page fault. Okay.
The top end pages shouldn't be the top end pages which are less expensive to replace.
It's a lower end page.
Yeah, here we are talking about the least cost end page.
Right. From that equation.
And that's the idea. So the N is the minimum amount of free frames that you need to maintain at any given time. So you keep flushing those minimum. So you have a set of all pages in memory, right? And each of these pages has a replacement cost, right, computed by that equation, right? And these costs are changing as the ranks keep changing. It also changes when you flush a page, because then the dirty bit changes. Right? So if you flush it out, it's no longer dirty until the point it gets written to again. The idea is that if we sort all these pages according to their cost, then the lowest cost pages should be clean, or N pages should be clean. And that allows us to service a page fault without having to evict the page, because we can immediately use one of those bottom end pages to as a replacement page, as a victim. Right. So that's the idea, to use the bottom end low cost end pages.
Yeah.
And keep those clean. And it's not that we need to flush them to flash every time. If they are already clean, we don't need to flush them.
Yeah,
because I mean that will raise more the durability issue, right? I mean you only have 1,000 writes per block. I mean you don't want to be writing all the time, because then it probably will be more expensive to keep buying flash because your flash is just not working anymore than to just put another RAM.
Yeah, so the point is that you don't need to write to flash until it's necessary because you ran out of this buffer of 3 frames.
But are you flushing it continuously? Some amount?
Only if they're dirty. Like the lowest cost pages, let's sort all the pages by their cost. When we look at the lowest cost n pages, and periodically flush any dirty page within those n pages. If the lowest cost pages are low cost because they are not so popular, the expectation is that they don't get modified too frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the flushing cost will not.
So what about if, for instance, some of the? No, sorry. The question doesn't make sense.
So we're thinking that we probably have a problem. So the thing is that if we have the list, I guess, m pages, in terms of cost, then if we flush them, their cost will change.
Their cost will only go down. So that it's if you see that what will happen.
Oh, their cost will go down. I see.
It cannot go up.
It cannot go up. Okay.
And therefore, they continue to remain the lowest cost.
Okay.
Pages.
That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What it would be interesting is to have in these n pages, it would be the cost. Okay. The thing is that if we have these n pages with the lowest cost, but it would be better to have there the pages that will have the lowest cost if they don't have to be written. Yeah, let's say that we calculate the cost based on this. Only the rank and the. Yeah, anyway, after the two, I need to think about
Because the cost of flushing also needs to be minimized, right?
Yeah.
We want to minimize that cost.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and if they are breathing all the time, then it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. So talking about a different topic, this is also another problem of the system. So as you see, we need a special replacement mechanism than in the normal cases, because now we need to take into account the cost of writing, which can be, in the case of flash, can be high. And now we also have an allocation mechanism to a flash, which also needs some thinking, and actually doesn't work in the normal case, which is in the normal commodity virtual memory system. I don't have this information here, but I review three operating systems, and usually they don't care much about doing sequential writes, which is something important in flash. So what we are trying to do is to write as sequential as we can in the flash, and we reduce the latencies of writing to the flash. So we have several allocations.
Just one thing about that: why they don't really care about writing sequentially?
I think
maybe you have some
question.
Idea.
Well, actually, what they care is about having
writing a large chunk of memory sequentially. So co-locating all the write operations together.
I guess what they want is to co-locate pages to be read efficiently, right, when a page falls across. But right now, that's in the case of the prefetch.
Just to make the write operation efficient. So let's say that you write a whole bunch of pages, we write them together so that you have only one I/O operation instead of multiple I/O operations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea. But they don't think about writing sequentially continuously in all those write operations. And that's because swapping is a rare operation. Right? Most of the time, the disk is busy doing file system I/O.
Right.
And therefore, it doesn't make sense to optimize for sequential writing inside the flash. It's not going to be sequential anyway, because the disk is going to service a large number of file system IOs before doing the next log operation.
So then what you're saying is that if you dedicate a single disk for swap, then that wouldn't be a problem.
If you dedicate a single disk for swap, then even then it doesn't make sense because swapping is a rare operation.
Okay.
And if you try to write sequentially, you at least have rotational delay because the disk is going to be spinning while you're not swapping. And therefore, you lost sequentiality.
Right.
So there is this time dimension associated with sequentiality on this. And only if you do those sequential IOs back to back, are you going to get sequential performance? Otherwise, the platter will rotate and you lose sequentiality if you stop.
Right.
So one other question I had, I mean, wouldn't you be reducing the reliability because you're writing dirty pages to the flash instead of the disk, and that mapping you don't have anywhere? Or you're going to keep that mapping somewhere?
No, but the thing is that you don't need to keep consistency in that case, right? That would be like the normal.
No, because a normal case you would write the dirty pages to disk.
Yeah, but that would.
And in this case you would write into flash. So are you keeping some mapping?
So when you have something like a BD flush,
mm-hmm.
The BD flush will work in the same way. If you have a dirty page in flash, what will happen is that the BD flush will generate a page for that specific page, and then it will write to the disk. Right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I illustrated that, what I was trying to say. So you're saying that some pages, you're instead of swapping them, you're putting them to the flash, and some of that group of pages are the pages that are the pages that you read from disk.
Like the page pair.
Like the page. Okay. So those could probably be dirty.
Okay.
So let's suppose you get a dirty page in the page cache and you write it to flash.
Okay.
Right? That's a possible scenario.
Because you
and then you have a crash.
Because you're big, that page.
Because you're big, that page. And then you have a crash.
Okay.
So now you have the latest copy on the flash, and the copy on disk is an old copy.
Okay.
Right? If it was a normal system,
okay,
that page would have been written to disk.
How?
Because it was evicted from the page cache and it's dirty, so you have to write it to disk.
But if you have a larger memory, it won't be evicted, right?
Yeah, but my concern is it's still with the reliability.
No, but this flash is volatile. You don't consider it to be like a right?
I know it's not volatile, but if you have some mapping, I mean, you're changing the consistency.
No, I think you're not.
What he's trying to say is that, let's say you have a 200 meg and you have some memory. So now you're using 500 meg.
Yeah, but what if you don't have it?
You have a big memory. So you have a system crash. So in any way, your in-memory data will be lost.
Yeah,
you
but that
you're keeping
probably
in mind, right?
No.
Yeah, I think this is a very basic question that we need to probably address.
It's fine. The thing is that, you have 8 gigabytes of RAM, right? And you have a situation where, as you said, you read a page
from a file, you dirty that page, and then you need to evict that. In the normal case, then PDFlush will come, or, well, you need to evict it, something else.
I mean, you eventually just write it to this.
Right. So you evict that page, and you write to this. In the case, in this case, where what happens is that you now reduce that 2 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes to 2 gigabytes, let's say. And you will use 32 gigabytes.
But that's not argument enough, I think. I mean, you need to, because, I mean, you're altering the semantics. Now, before you had some miss.
You're not altering anything. You have exactly the same consistency. So let me finish.
No, I mean, because you're saying that now, because you have less memory, you would. I mean, you're assuming that now you would have the same amount of memory.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying is that let me finish the example to see if it's like very right thing. So you now have 2 gigabytes of RAM, and you have 32 gigabytes of SSD. But from that SSD, you're only using 6 gigabytes. Right, to complete the 8 gigabytes that you had before. That makes sense? Okay. In this configuration, in the previous scenario, you now will read the file to memory in the page cache, and you dirty that page. Let's say that for some reason the hard memory decides to read that page to the flash. Right? So if that is the case, this case doesn't fit, but so if you have something like PDFlush, which flushes the pages all the time, every 5 seconds, I think, you will have PDFlush will try to flush that page effectively. So what will happen is that PDFlush will read that page from memory, but that page won't be on memory. So it will generate a fault, will bring that page into memory, and then we flush to the disk. So you have exactly the same consistency.
Yeah, but let's assume now you're not using 6, you're using 20 on the flash, because you have more.
No, but the PDFlush will run continuously, and it will ask for the page. And if it's not found in memory, it will ask from the flash, and it will bring it back to the flash and write it back to the disk.
I get what you're saying, but now that the thing is that since you have a bigger flash, you have more memory, you have more likely for this to happen.
Right.
So the more likely for this to happen, the less you're going to write to this.
Right.
So the more possibility that you're going to have a stale copy on this.
Okay. So you say that, let's say that you increase what you export from the SSD to 20 gigabytes, as you said. Right? So now you have a RAM of 22 gigabytes. Yeah. That would be, in some sense, now you need to compare that with a 22 gigabyte RAM, which in turn would be the same.
I mean, the thing that I'm saying, that probably you could have an easier solution just if you keep a mapping somehow of the what pages are belong to what file system location, or not file system, to what this location.
Yeah, but things will be more complicated, and I don't think we need to, because the consistency, we're guaranteeing exactly the same consistency as before.
Yeah, I guess you're going after better consistency than existing.
Exactly.
Because we have a persistent. But our goal is not better consistency, it's just better performance. But that could be a
word that But I'm not sure. I mean, it's not better performance. You will have the same performance.
Sorry, better power.
Better power consumption.
Yeah.
I mean, at most.
So I guess if you have big memory, you have higher, you have lesser consistency, right? Because you can keep a lot of things in memory.
Another thing I don't see is how when you have a dirty page on flash and not on memory.
Say that again?
How when you have a dirty page on the flash and not on the real memory?
Could be that, let's say, yeah, it's easy. So you have all the pages used in memory, and you need to bring something to from flash to memory. And you only have dirty pages in RAM, so you evict one of them, right? You evict that into the flash, and then bring that to memory.
Oh, you evict dirty in flash. You leave it as there is still on the flash.
Yeah,
you leave it like it was before.
Yeah, so actually there is one change because you're incurring in memory overhead by your system. So you're going to have some small amount of more page faults. Right? So at the end.
So you're talking about the.
Doing this, you're going to be using some memory to store metadata, right?
Absolutely.
So that memory, it's some overhead.
Right.
So it's gonna add some amount of page faults.
Page faults. Actually, those pages. Well, in our case.
Yeah, because you're gonna bring more pages to the flash. Before you were gonna bring to the
page faults are gonna be higher, definitely than the previous.
Yeah, but even if you have an overhead of zero, you will have more page faults, right?
Yeah. Well. But I'm saying that the number of page faults is gonna increase, not only because you have less memory, but also because you're using some amount of memory for your system.
Okay.
Right.
So
and probably you will have some page faults that before you would not have, even with the large memory.
Right.
Right. So that could compromise. I mean,
performance.
Yeah.
I think performance is going to be compromised anyway.
And not reliability.
Reliability. How reliability would be compromised?
Because you're not. We can talk about this later. Because we're taking too much.
Yeah. Okay. So I forgot to talk about this. So first we have the normal allocation, which is a static mapping. It's just a mapping one to one from pages to flash, right? And after that will be fixed while the page lives. So this will create a lot of fragmentation, right? Because now if a page dies, then you will have that specific page free in flash, and you need to fill it with another 4K page, and that would create a lot of fragmentation. So another solution is logging with cleaning, which is based in Pyro, the log structure file system. So the idea is that now we're going to divide the flash in segments, and we're going to write those segments completely, right? And they cannot be written if they are not clean, meaning that before you can go ahead and write again to a segment, you need to clean first. So at the beginning, it's really nice. At the beginning, you have all the flash completely clean, and we all want to write all the flash sequential, but when we run out of segments, we need to clean segments in order to perform more writes to the flash.
How do you clean the flash?
Sorry? How do you clean the page, the segment? In our case, it will be that because over time we'll have a full segment, and some of the pages in that segment are going to die or going to be overwritten in some other segment, meaning that we start having holes in the segment of empty pages. So we'll have dead pages and live pages in the same segment. And we need to, when we clean, we need to take those clean pages and write it to another segment so we can leave the segment completely free.
Okay, so
No, because these segments are meant to be really big, right? Big, so large, yeah.
Yes. So you are putting the free space into every strong class together to make a big chunk of free space.
Yes. So at the end you will have big chunks of free space.
So my question is, how do you, let's say if you have a page on the flash and it's dirty, right? So you need, but you need the space of that page. For example, if the entire all the pages in Flash are all dirty, so now you need a free space in Flash. So you have to delete one of the pages, right? And that page is dirty. So what do you do? At that time.
Maybe I can speed it up a little bit. So the Flash has 32 gigabytes, let's say.
Mm.
Out of that, only it's using 8 gigabytes of real estate. So the remaining 24 gigabytes are free.
Oh.
So there will always be free space on the Flash. Because we are trying to simulate 8 gigabytes of memory with 2 gigabytes of memory and 32 gigabytes.
Okay.
Okay, so another allocation technique we use is logging, log padding, which is we again divide the flash in segments, but now the segment writes are performing a read modify write way. So so in this case, we don't need to have the segment completely clean to be able to write in that segment. We read all the pages to memory, we introduce the new pages we want, and we write the whole segment again. So the good thing is that no cleaning is required, and the bad thing is that we have a higher latency now because we need to read the whole segment first and then write. But the good thing is that we have less variance compared to the cleaning, right? In the case of the cleaning, if the cleaning, the garbage collection through the cleaning is triggered while some application is doing some work, then probably that application will see these delays as a foreground latency. Right?
So you will write in place?
Yes, exactly.
Not necessarily statically. I mean, that location can move up,
okay,
depending on which segment you write.
Okay. Yeah, but the thing is that of this approach is that it's like we are doing the cleaning right away. We're not leaving the cleaning for later on, but we're doing it online. Okay. So In both cases, in the case of cleaning and in the case of spanning, we need to select segments to clean or to pass, right? So for these two operations, we have several, I think we have probably six approaches that take into account trying to do better performance. Usually the target is to have better performance or have a good square leveling in the Flash. Okay, so the first one is a performance greedy approach where we select the segment to clean or pass that gives better performance. In the case of cleaning, the idea is that we select the segments that have the lower utilization first. So we don't have to read much data, and we free a lot of space at once. Okay. In the case of padding, it's somewhat similar, is that we select the segment to pass that have the lowest utilization, so we take advantage of most of the segment space in the first try. So, well, I guess one obvious problem of this is that it's probably word leveling, so we are not counting the number of iterations that we have in each segment, so that could be a problem. And a less obvious problem is it's a problem of the log structure path system, where when there is locality, this leads to really bad performance, not only in the path system performance, but also in the cleaning performance.
So maybe, Louis, you can just talk about this and the other one, the two of them, and skip over the other ones, because I mean, we are sort of running out of time. Maybe
okay.
We can just talk about the clock and then we could...
Okay. So, I guess then we have the clock, which is basically we put all the segments in a clock-like way, and then we have a pointer which selects the segment to clean or to pass first, and then the clock goes one step further and so on. Okay. So the I guess the primary goal of this clock segment selection is wear level, right? So we're exactly doing the same number of erasers in all the segments at the same time.
So that's assuming that all the segments get erased.
Yes, I'm assuming that each time I rewrite a segment, I'm doing some kind of erasure, right?
Because there could be segments that don't get replaced, right? So they're the same, and so you would have to put them again.
So
erasure is unavoidable. So when you write, before you write to Flash, you have to erase.
No, I'm not talking. I'm saying that. So let's say, I'm not gonna ask my question.
We're already
waiting. Well, okay.
We saved a lot of time by skipping over this.
Okay, so this is, I guess, a summary. So the only two we saw is that the performance reading, which the performance that is the primary goal, and the case of the clock, the primary goal is the wear level. So these are the to-dos. So first, we need to finish the motivation. Second, I need to finish the code. And third, we need to do the evaluation. And the last one, I guess, just traces some more tricks. The thing is that to do the evaluation and the motivation, the way we design these two sections, we need to have traces of memory. And as starts out, getting memory traces is not very easy. So you have tried quite some experiments. So if you want to see it that way, this is like a requirement for motivation and evaluation. Okay.
For memory trace is like the physical address. Or?
Yeah, we need basically the timestamp and I guess a physical address and also a piece of load to store.
And the content of that address.
No,
not
really. Yeah, and from that, I mean, because it's not only the load and store, it's also the instructions that you read to execute, you know, from the CPU. It's also the DMA when some operations come.
All memory access.
Yeah, all memory access. Yeah, that's it.
So one question I had was, it's not that related. So it's the power consumption of the RAM linear? I mean, the more you have, it's a linear relation? How is the relationship?
Linear on throughput.
What? Linear
on throughput.
But on amount. I'm talking about on amount. I mean, if you have 2 gigabytes and you have 4, you're using twice as many in 4.
Linear throughput plus a constant because of the number of memory bytes. Something like that.
But you mentioned that it's almost linear, right?
But the constant is linear on the amount of bytes.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Mainly it's because of truth.
If you have all the memory
items, there's a difference.
It would be linear.
Yeah. But the access is different, of course. Yeah. Depends.
So it's linear on the amount. Okay.
Yeah. As long as. Right.
And. Going from let's say 2 to 4, you're always doubling the amount of bits.
Well, I guess it also depends on the workload. But if it's totally idle.
No, but yeah, let's say you have the. I mean, let's assume that just a basic scenario that you're always using the same workload. And
always using the same workload.
And it's always using the maximum memory. I mean, I just want to know if it's always gonna use double as the memory as
no,
double
not
the power
exactly,
as the double as.
If you have exactly the same workload and you're using exactly the same region of memory, then what you're going to have in the power consumption will be only the idle memory that you are introducing. I mean the idle banks that you're introducing.
So if you increase your workload by two times, then your power consumption will also increase two times.
Yeah. So there is it's not as simple as what we are discussing here, because it depends on what are the pages that are being used. There is a whole line of research which talks about how to manage memory so it is power aware.
Yeah.
By putting the pages that are being used in the same memory bank. Right. And by default, the operating system doesn't do that. The operating system can have active pages in all the memory banks, in which case all the memory banks are active. And then you're paying the price of power to keep all the banks active. That's the normal scenario. And there is research that suggests how we can co-locate the active pages in fewer banks so that the remaining banks can be in idle state or standby. So that's still an active area of research. Operating systems don't do that. So this is, and that goes to power energy proportionality. So that technique where you can dynamically place the number of active pages in fewer active banks, and then the number of active banks is proportional to the number of active pages, energy proportionality. Here we are going after energy efficiency. We are not going after proportionality at all. So just improving the base energy efficiency of the system.
So I guess in that work they do this for mainly for user space programs. I'm guessing that the current probably they cannot move it.
Well, you could do the same thing that we are doing here.
Something similar to what we're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it could be done because still research, right? So all possibilities are open.
Power consumption is really getting important in a lot of fields.
I guess people are giving it more importance now.
But $300.
No, even there is a new proposal from the energy department that if you build a bulb,
series, no?
Of 1/6 of in or 1/6 of the normal bulb,
I thought it was
they will give
much,
some
much
millions
much
of dollars.
A bulb per price.
Well, yesterday I went to a store. I mean, a store that sells bulbs, right? Uh-huh. And they have this new low power fluorescent.
No, even that is not the fluorescent. Now it's the LCD bulbs are coming.
LCD bulbs. I don't know about that. The ones that were being sold were
not LED.
LED
bulbs.
It doesn't make sense to make
LED bulbs. LED bulbs. No, they were saying the fluorescent bulbs are not that effective.
Yeah, but I'm just telling you what I saw, right? In the store, I saw a bulb which says 11 watts. Okay. And then I want to buy a 60 watt bulb because that's the one that broke in my house. So I cannot find 60 watt. But then I saw the 11 watt in the, if you look at the package, it says equivalent to 60 watts of the
regular
tungsten regular filament bulb. Right? So. Mm-hmm. So now the problem is that if you want to replace a bulb, you also need to look more carefully which wattage you're buying.
I think
and you get a 60 watt.
A lot of European countries are already banning the tungsten bulb.
What's that?
A lot of European countries are already banning the tungsten bulb.
Yeah, it is coming from the right. But they still have problems.
Okay.
Philips has claimed that they made a fast LED bulb, 1/6 of energy. Of normal.
Yeah, it is normal.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about another project for your board of me. this project is me with a whole bunch of people, including Daniel, Leonardo, Raju, Ming, Jason, and probably more. Okay, so the idea is that we have three goals, right? So the first one that we're tackling is recoverability. So the idea behind recoverability is that we have HPC applications that execute during long periods of time, and if they fail, they have to be restarted, right? So what typically you do in those scenarios is that you checkpoint, right? So you maintain checkpoints of the application, and that also has some issues. Another of the goals that we have is record replay, right? So again, HPC applications generate a lot amount of data, and sometimes scientists just want to go through the whole process of how that data is created. Let's say simulation, right? You want to simulate some explosion or let's not say explosion, let's say some the Big Bang, right? You want to simulate the Big Bang.
That's probably the
yeah. So so you want to see how things go through in the middle steps, right? So you want to be able to go to some point of execution, see how the state looks like, then go to the next point and see how it looks like, right? So you want to see, visualize the different steps. And the final step is execution branching, right? So let's say you're doing your simulation of the Big Bang, and suddenly you want to change some parameter because, let's say, I don't know, one of the Newton's law was found to be bad. And
what?
And I don't know, and need some constant there, and you want to change some of the parameters, right? So at some point, probably hurricane models are more accurate for this.
Yeah.
So you want to have probably just the path that you executed before, and possibly another path with another different model, right? So that's execution branch. So we have these three different goals that we want to accomplish. And
I just want to say that if you say something like that in a
no, this is just informal.
You better make it sure that you're joking.
Yeah,
I mean, make it clear that you're joking, because if you appear serious, then people will.
Yeah, probably you're making simulations. Okay. So, anyways, so our idea is that we want developers to be aware of what data they're modifying, right? So they want to be able to allocate and have some memory that is persistent, but they know when they're writing the application which memory they want to be persistent and which doesn't, right? So in that sense, we're going to use persistent memory is going to provide two additional guarantees that normal memory doesn't have. The first one is durability, and the second one is that it's the durable persistence and immutable persistence, right? So memory that is persistent is not going to be modified unless the application modifies it, and yeah.
The durability is about not having to lose memory.
Yeah.
When there is a crash or a power failure. It's there. It's always mm-hmm. there. Just like you write it to a disk, it's there.
Okay.
Immutable persistence means that your data, when you make changes,
you're
always making a change on a copy. The data cannot really change by itself. Cannot be mutable. Not mutable. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the high-level idea is that if we have a process executing, and that process has some address space, and at some point it writes page X to this, then at a later moment that process wants to resume execution, he restores X, but know that could lead to a different portion in the address space, right? So there are some tricks that we have to play with. Okay, so in terms of our three goals, we have an API that's going to support those three goals, and that API is going to use what we call LIMA, that stands for Location Independent Memory Allocator. We have some components that manage the memory that's allocated to the process, or let's say to the application, and it transfers to another component that is the one that handles all the interactions with the disk, with the different types of disk, sorry. So LIMA, what it does is that it handles virtual memory, right? So it knows all the information about the virtual memory. So what it's going to do is going to pack that virtual memory into what we call chunks, and those chunks are going to be reintroduced in an efficient way that depends on the characteristics of the different types of underlying devices, right? So let's say if you have a local hard disk, you're going to write it in some way. If you have an SSD, you're going to write it in some other way. And if you have a parallel file system on the other side, you're going to write it in some different way, right? Okay, so there are two types of containers that we provide. So the simple container is one where we have one instance. And that one instance we keep updating all the time. And basically, yes, has some other characteristics that I'm not going to talk about. The other type of container is a version container. So in this case, every time you create a persistence point, you write to a new location, so you don't overwrite what you had before. Right? It's like creating a snapshot. Right? So each time you can see a persistence point as a snapshot. So you will keep all snapshots, but and those are in some sense read only. And if you want to modify them, you will create a branch. Right, that would be useful for execution branching that we saw. And
one question about the version container. So what you're saying is that all the versions would be in memory?
No. Those versions will be on a persistent store. And you will be able to browse through the versions and select one that you want to load.
So only the latest?
Yeah, you will only version. One version, no, not the late, not necessarily the latest. But only one version could be loaded at a time.
Okay. The other versions could stay in
place. Yeah, the other versions will be.
So if an application needs to retrieve, then it could be retrieved.
Exactly.
You could have multiple versions if you're doing execution branch. Right?
So
you could have one container version that's operated by one thread and another container that's being managed by the other thread.
Yeah. In that case, you could have. Well, I didn't thought of it that way, but yeah, probably you could have it. You could have multiple loaded in that case.
So,
mm-hmm.
those are read-only, right? The version?
Previous version.
Previous version.
Yeah, if you want to write, you need to create a branch.
You need to create a branch.
Yeah. I mean, this is just future work. We haven't done any of this.
Oh, okay.
This is just planning.
Okay.
Okay.
Would it be safe to say that this behaves similar to the version control system, like Git, for instance?
Yes.
But for memory.
Yeah. Okay. So, let's look at an example. So, let's suppose we have this code. It's just a list, right? We have that has a value and a pointer to the next. And we have this... And we have this function that basically just allocates different guys so the first line will simply create a box, right? The malloc will create a box of the type. The second will assign the B value and so on. So this one will also allocate a box, assign a value, and then the pointer will just be a guy that has the address of the other box, and we can see it as that arrow, and so on and so forth, right? So in order to make that application compatible with software persistent memory, the first thing that we need to do is that we need to, some lines are blue, but it's not that noticeable here, so.
Okay. The lines are blue?
Yeah. The changes are blue.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
I think they're a little hard to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing that changes is that now we have a structure at the beginning that is the container. So in the container, we want to put everything that we want to make persistent, right? That's the first thing that changes. The second thing that changes is that now, we're going to check if we're in a restore or we're in a normal execution, right? So
if we restore, we're just not gonna bypass all the allocation part, right? And if we're I'll go to the restore part later. So in the first case, we're not on restore. We have the process that has three memory pages. So the first thing that it does is that it allocates it creates a container, right? So that means that it allocates some actual guy inside the process address space and says, hey, in P, so in the memory page P1, in that address I have a point, right? So pmalloc is just a guy saying, okay, I allocate this other guy, and there's gonna be there's a pointer here also, right? So I also write this pointer out. It follows about the same for the rest of the guys, right? Okay, and at some point you write it all to this, right? So okay. So basically now at this point we have a list of pointers and some memory that's loaded onto memory, and we write it to disk efficiently.
Right now we're not going to worry about that. Right? Okay, so what happens when we restore? When we restore, the execution stops here, right? Because it says, okay, so now there is something that you have to restore and before you continue. So the first thing that you do is you load that first page into memory. So you load it as it was, right? So what we see here, page 1 has O1, X, all that, right? So we load it as it was. And we additionally keep this information here that says, previously was called, it was in this address, P1, and now it's in this address, P5, right? But the thing is that now, remember that before, those were address OX, O0, O1, O2, and O3. Right now, they're different addresses because this PI might not be the same P1. Right? Mm-hmm. So those are different addresses in the virtual address space. Okay. So when we load page 2, and then we load page 3. Right? So right now, everything is on memory. All the data that we had exactly as was before was it's on memory, but it doesn't make any sense. Because this guy is pointing to O1 that's probably not in the address space of this process.
It's in the address space.
It's in the address space, but it probably contains some other information, right?
So I have a question. So what is the motivation of not having or not loading that page in the previous address?
Okay, so one thing is for security reasons, right? Let's say your application has a bug, and someone knows how to exploit that bug. Right, so you don't want to load it. You don't want to give the same. You don't want to have everything always in the same locations because of that. So that's something that's called address space randomization. That is implemented by the operating system, not by us.
Okay.
Right. So typically, the operating system will randomize the heap memory and also the stack. And the other thing is that we would have to allocate memory in the exact same order, right? Assuming we don't have randomization, we would have to allocate everything in exactly the same order as we did in the first time that we were running, and that's almost impossible.
Why is that?
Because so you would have to basically rerun all the program to know how you allocated memory.
Sorry again. Sorry, what you would have to rerun?
The whole program, because I mean, if you just put things back, they might not be they might not make sense for the program anymore. Let me
if you put functions and you put things on the stack and the program counter was at some point, the stack is different as it was before the top of the, right?
Also the configuration of the heap memory. We are talking about heap memory here, right? Because it's going through a malloc operation.
Yeah.
Right? So the heap memory could be arbitrarily configured at the time that you restore your container, and the pages that locations or frames that you I shouldn't say frames, but the pages that you need may already be occupied. That's the problem. Even if you are not occupied, then you need to request a lot of memory from the operating system, or actually in this case the library, before it gives you the right pages for you to use.
Actually, you have control. I mean, for example, malloc is implemented with an nmap usually. For an nmap, you can specify, give me memory here, at this point.
Right.
You can do it.
Yeah, I guess you can do that if it is available.
If it's not available, you just rewrite it.
If it's not available,
you're not supposed to rewrite stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, what I was thinking is that with nmap, you can, I guess you can do something like allocating a third or a second heap, right, for this kind of memory that is far from the from the first heap, which in we're talking about architecture with 64 bits would be even better, right?
Mapping to the same location as the earlier problem, which is a security problem, because if people know how where you're how you're managing your memory, then that's one of the classic avenues for attacks.
So I don't understand that. How does that work? I mean, how can somebody attack if...
I think Yampei could probably explain.
So, let's say the attacker started your
computer
and then want to attack your problem application. And the attacker started your binary code or your source code and I think the example is about the Buffalo's rule. So let's say your program has an important variable for something pointer, right? It points to system, some library, that something pointer. The attacker wants to override that variable so that it can point to somewhere else where the malicious code is in the picture, right? So then the attacker first needs to find out the location of that variable in your address space. So if you always put this variable at the same location, then the attacker can develop and implement the program and look at the fixed location and override it. So that's why we have a fixed layout of your variables, and you are more vulnerable to attack.
Yeah. I guess the other question is, how, I mean, because it seems like this is, this kind of system is or this kind of persistent memory is called is for high performance machines. So my question So I guess my concern is if these kind of security problems happen in that kind of application. I'm guessing
They're running the same operating system.
Right. But these are But these machines are exported to the world or
I think these are two abnormal issues. So the high performance application is not a guarantee it will be a secure application. But they can be the same at the same time.
I think it's also another way of looking at it, right?
Yeah.
We know that there are vulnerabilities if you map code to known location, and there is a solution. Why not use the solution and we show that there's not too much overhead in actually making it secure?
Yeah.
The only thing that you need to do is when you restore, you need to go through the list of pointers and fix all the values. And there you have a secure system. Why not use a secure system? Yeah, and some people might claim that it is a critical advantage, right? That it's critical to the system to be secure.
Yeah, and the overhead is not as much. It's just when you're loading. It's just, it's something that you do one time. It's not that like you're always modifying the pointers.
Okay.
So these are, in this case, you're placing these pages in the heap, let's say, or?
Yes, in the heap. Okay. So, yeah, so now I would basically have to go through, I will have to see all the P1s in this table and modify them with the PI, sorry. All right, so that's basically the first one, the O0. I modify to A1, right, using the same mapping, and do the same thing for all the guys, right? So, and then for the other page, I modify that. Okay. So what are some of the challenges that we have? So one thing is that we need to make containers self-describing. That is, a container has to be a unit that can be probably moved from one location to another without containing, sorry, and being loadable in the other location, right? Because we want this to be used in high-performance environment. The other challenge is to detect changes, right? So probably this goes into what Luis is doing, is that every time we do a write to memory, we don't have a page fault. It's just a write to memory, right? So we need to have a way to know that, hey, that portion is written, so that page is dirty, and you need to write it to this eventually, right? And okay, so another thing is of the challenges is how do we support versioning and branching? And yeah, we have some ideas.
So I guess the other advantage of making that memory independent is that you can load an arbitrary container into an arbitrary address space, which could be of a different program.
Of a different architecture, yeah.
Into a different architecture, perhaps, into a different executable. You can load multiple containers that may be conflicting otherwise. Now they don't no longer conflicting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of the address space. Yeah, that's a big advantage, I would say. Okay, so... these are some of the ideas that we have to deal with this problem. So all the pages in the container are aligned with the address space. So yeah, I think I mean the key things that we're working on right now. This is probably what I'm going to talk about is this one. That is what Leonardo and Daniel are working on. That is tracking of pointers at compile time, so the developer has to do less work in order to make his application compatible with us. And this change that we tackled by making pages read only, and then we get an interruption, and that way we mark the page as dirty, and then we just make it just. Read and write, so we don't get that interruption all the time. There are many challenges here, and I mean nice ideas that we have. Probably I don't have time to talk about all of them.
So all this is implemented in user space, or you need kernel?
All this, the idea is to implement all this in user space. But I'm guessing that eventually we're gonna have to write some portions in the kernel. Yeah, but at least until now everything has been implemented.
Why is that? I mean, what do you have to write in the kernel?
I'm not sure, but I'm guessing. I mean, it's not complete. Yeah.
So you don't feel like this is a systems project unless you write some kernel code.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a systems project. I don't have any doubt about it. We're messing with a whole bunch of stuff regarding the process, but yeah.
And storage as well, right?
Yeah.
So, I have a question regarding, could you go back to the slide where you have the mapping between the previous or the preview?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So P1 now becomes PI and P2, PA and P3, PK, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these are the pages, and you keep track of these pages because those are the pages that have pointers in your...
No, I keep track of all the pages. And some of those, for instance, we see that
So we see these are all the pages, and we see that only C1 and C2 have pointers.
But these are the pages within your container, right? These are not all the pages for your program. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are the pages for the container, yes.
Only for the container.
Yes.
So if we do the same mapping for all the pages for the program, we just solve the issue of track of, then we don't have to keep track of the... we don't have to detect the points, right? Because we have the mapping for all the pages. Although we won't use all the pages, it's not necessary for us. But I'm thinking, oh, if we keep the same mapping for all the pages that the program is using.
Yeah, but then the same thing if the program changes and it's not exactly the same.
There you only need the pages, right? You need the mapping of the pages because the offset is going to be the same. Or you need to know it.
But the problem is that we don't know what is a pointer and what is a regular data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The goal is to go and fix those pointer values.
Correct. That's
because the thing is that okay, so
all you have to do is update the page number. Because the offset will be the same.
Right, but you need to know where the point
is. So, Leonardo, look at this page. For instance, in this page, in this time, when we allocate, when we have a pmalloc, see that we populate the page, the list of pointers.
Right.
Right. In the case of the whole program, we will not have that information. We still have to know where the pointers are. That's what Raj was saying. We still have the same problem.
In the end, the way we are using the pointer list and the new and old addresses of the page are to go and pick the values of those pointers, wherever those pointers may be in the container address space. So we need to know the locations of the pointers so we know which locations to change. If we don't know the location of the pointers, then it's the entire container address space, and we have to search for the pointers, and there is no information to look for them. I don't know if that makes sense.
I'm not really clear yet, but I guess we can talk about that.
No, I mean, the page is just numbers. One number below the other. So how do we know that this number is not an integer and it's a pointer pointing to another page when you go through it? Right? So this might be a signer in, and this one might be a pointer to a place that now is not the same place. So you need to update this number. But you don't know if that number is a pointer or is a signer thing.
Mm-hmm. You said that you don't have that information for the pages that are not part of the container.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we cannot do it, because we don't have that information.
No, I mean, the thing is that still you have to know which ones are pointers, because you still have to populate that table with the pointer information.
Are you talking about restoring the pointers for the non-container pages?
Well, when we say updating the pointer, basically what we're doing is updating the page number, right? Because the pointer will have information, okay, it's going to be this page,
on some
offset,
offset. Mm-hmm.
Right?
No,
the offset is not going to change.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That never changes.
Yeah.
So pretty much all we have to do is update the page number.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So if we have access to all the pages, not only the ones within the container, and we keep the mapping of those, then...
But how do I know which location of the memory...
Which offsets to update? Because then...
No, the offsets don't get updated.
Which locations? Yeah, actually, the offsets is what you update.
The offset of where the pointer is.
So you have a pointer here, and this is what you update, the offset within the page. So how do you know which ones of these guys to update? You need to keep track in the pointer table.
So the pointer table keeps track of the location of the pointers within the various pages. Right.
How you use them in the new numbers?
Because I know where I loaded that page. I know the old one and I know the new one.
Oh,
yeah. Right, and that's why I have to build that table.
So the persistent memory can be intermingled with the non-persistent memory.
Yeah.
So you can be storing in persistent
Not memory. Within the same page. There are distinct pages that contain persistent data and other pages that contain non-persistent data.
So they are both separated.
Yeah.
At the page granularity.
So
I could have a persistent page, non-persistent persistent page, non-persistent.
So the way it works is that we allocate a page and we start every time we get a p malloc that is our.
You allocate a new page.
We allocate a new page and then we start putting stuff in it. And when it gets full, we allocate another one. Well, it actually is a little bit more complicated, but just
think of it as that.
Yeah, and I have another question. So if you have a persistent data structure that points to a non-persistent data structure, how do you have
okay, if that pointer doesn't get recorded, then, I mean, when that gets updated, it's interpreted as a programming error.
Okay.
Or as if that data
actually,
is not important.
Yeah, will be treated as a normal input.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that will not get updated, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Shouldn't you analyze that dependency and make that other stuff persistent?
So, the thing is that, I mean, that could be either, it could be a bug, or it could be on purpose,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, I mean, it's nice for a programmer to be lazy and only allocate the root as persistent and then don't have to remember about what else is
yeah.
good, right?
Yeah.
Lazy programmers.
No,
probably.
I mean,
so the problem is that, so what you're saying is discover all the
dependencies.
All the dependencies.
Yes. And also, that goes to my second question.
Uh-huh.
So, the way you discover that something is a pointer that you should track is because it has been allocated with a pmalloc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what happens with...
No. Sorry.
No.
Because you have to say explicitly there's a pointer here.
Yeah.
So you need to tag the structure.
You need to tag the address of the pointer.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. You tag the actual... You tag addresses. That's the only thing you tag.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's the part that we are trying to make automatic, so the programmer doesn't have to do that. But the programmer does have to, at this, or at least at current understanding, maybe there's a dependency analysis that we can use to further simplify, which we haven't really
mm-hmm.
thought through so much.
Yeah.
But at this point, all memory that needs to be persistent has to be allocated with a pmap.
Okay, doesn't make much sense that, I mean, a programmer wants to make some type of data persistent instead of some instantiation of data persistent. And that goes to the idea of shouldn't a programmer be tagging the structures instead of tagging stuff that he wants to persistently allocate on the runtime?
Not necessarily. For instance, you could use the same matrix data structure as a temporary matrix. And then now you had to create a new matrix which stores temporary values that is non-persistent and other.
Well, you could see it as you have a different type of matrix that is structured, which is persistent because you define it in a persistent.
Yeah, let's say
you define
a group persistent something.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think it's the same.
I guess it's easier in some sense because then I don't have to, when I instantiate the structure each time, I don't have to worry about
it. Yeah, that's it. You define a persistent type, you just use it and it will be persistent.
And that could be done with preprocessor. We can automatically change it to the version that we are currently implementing. That could be automated.
So the question I have, so everything inside will be persistent?
Yeah.
But
unless you mark it or something like that.
Yeah, that has less flexibility, right? So you have to create a new version of the structure that you want to be persistent as well as non-persistent. But for potentially what you're suggesting can be transformed into what we are.
The only problem about that is that what do you do? Well, I feel we still have the same problem with let's say you have a type that you don't define. It's a .h that you include. You cannot make it persistent.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a good idea. It's a good idea.
And
have to.
So let's say you have a pointer. So you make the pointer point to let's say a couple of bytes after the start of a persistent structure. There's no way of that of you to know that this pointer is persistent. You need to tell the system keep this stuff persistent. And you do it by
a call. Right now,
but
it's
you don't want to allocate memory. You need another call to say this is persistent.
Yes.
So what is the interface you have? Pmalloc, pmalloc, and
p-pointer at.
P-pointer at.
Yeah. No, but then that p-pointer
will
go away.
Yeah, the idea is that will go away with what Leonardo and Daniel are doing.
Okay.
The idea is that the preprocessor will automatically introduce that p-pointer at
calls. So the programmer doesn't have to do that.
So what if, for example, I have a pointer P, which is persistent, and I say pointer A is P plus 10? How would you know?
Pointer A is
P plus 10.
So that, I mean, you're doing like an array or something like that. I mean, what
you
what
don't know the size of P. I mean, you now have to calculate the size of P. You now have, I mean, you know,
yeah,
you need to know if it's whether in the bounds of a page or.
Well, remember that.
No, yeah, but the thing is that we allocate that in a page exactly. So we do that at the allocation phase. When we allocate, we ensure that structure fits completely within a page.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I mean.
So I mean, you mean by checking the offset, you know that
it should be persistent or not.
Yeah.
Persistent or not, right?
Yes.
No, wait a minute.
No.
Okay, let me write.
Yeah. So basically, what you're, I mean, the thing is that I think. Okay. So. Oops, I don't know if I was supposed to write that.
No, that worked.
Okay. Perfect. So. Okay, so this is a page, right?
Yeah.
We allocate a page, and then let's say you come with a structure is persistent.
Yeah.
And we put it inside here.
Yeah.
If it doesn't fit in this page, now we don't want to allocate another guy, and let's say it would be something like this. But
yeah.
If it doesn't fit, we allocate another page and put that guy in the other page.
Yeah.
All right, so in that sense, we ensure that in the virtual address space is continuous.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so now if you do P plus something, and it's originally within the address space, within the memory region of that variable, it will still be within the memory region of that variable. If it's not, then I mean, the other case you also had an error.
But if you allocate a data structure or an instance of a data structure greater than the page size.
Yeah. Well. That's why I said it's a little bit more complicated. We have a swap allocator that has pages of different size and to manage free space and all that.
So
if
you have something
with
P plus 10, it's a constant. So you can do this with statistically, figure out if P plus 10 is a constant or not. Right?
You mean for pointer detection?
Yeah, P plus I is a variable.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that?
Okay, so you have a pointer at P, right?
P points to that.
And this is P. Let's say P is this guy.
Yeah.
And this P plus I.
That would be A, same in A. In pointer A, right?
Yeah, you say that in pointer A. So now you
so
have
now
to
you
be better.
Pointer
A.
At A.
What?
So
A equals that?
Wait, yeah, A equals that.
A is P.
No, A is P plus I.
A is P plus I.
And now you say pointer at A, and that's it, right?
So in what cases A is persistent and in what cases A is not persistent?
No, A will not be persistent.
A will not be persistent. But A is persistent,
I mean,
it might be pointing to a persistent error.
So if in the structure, you define that as A plus P plus I is a pointer, then it will be made persistent. When
so you still have the interface of saying this is a persistent pointer.
Okay, so let's go for instance the example here of the list. So in the list, here, see, for instance, every time you allocate, if you create a value, a struct, L star, you would have two pointers, right?
Yes.
The pointer to L star and the pointer to L star arrow N.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because N is the pointer. So in this case, if P plus I was, when you declare the structure, was declared as the I location is a pointer, then this will be marked with as a pointer.
Well, what is the P of an array?
If P is an array.
No, actually, if P is an integer, I think an array is also a pointer, so probably...
Array, yeah.
If P is a big buffer. Yeah,
it's still the array.
You should be able to point to whatever...
I think there is I might understand what the confusion is. If you point to a persistent memory, the pointer does not automatically become persistent.
Okay, yeah, that was the question. Yes.
The pointer has to be within a persistent allocation, and then the pointer becomes persistent.
Yeah.
But if you have a void star somewhere which was not allocated using, you know, that the location that stores the pointer value was not located was not allocated using pmalloc, then the pointer will be lost. It will not be restored. Only pointers within data structures that have been allocated using pmalloc will be restored.
So in that case, if you go to an SSLI, A will have to be on the structure right there, right?
Huh?
A will have to, A will have to be on P comp, right? A will have to be inside the
for this. Yeah, A will have to be there.
So if the programmer forgets to do that, then the program can crash.
But, I mean, we are, at this point, we are looking for ideas how to really bring the best or improve this whole idea of persistent memory in the best possible way. What do you think is easier, more natural?
Yeah, this is by no means finalized.
This is what we've been discussing so far.
So really, the thing is that giving a memory allocation, the cool thing would be to grab as much dependent stuff as possible.
Mm.
I mean, not bad to have a lot of stuff allocated.
But what
cheap is?
What would be the
if you detect that dependency, why not?
No, it's not about just cheap disk, it's also about storing the persistence point. So each time there is a change, you write that data out. Maybe you don't need it to be persistent, and so you're paying for all those I/O operations.
Unnecessarily. That's it's all over, right? We only need a flag saying that if you want that to be recorded or not. But the thing is that I don't understand how that would solve the problem. Because the thing is that if you don't do pmalloc, you will do malloc anyway, right? So in terms of programming, it won't reduce the number of lines that you...
No, but you might, for instance, forget to do a pmalloc for something that you want to be persistent. You can forget that because we are requiring all the stuff that you need to be persistent to be allocated with pmalloc.
Yes.
But, so the thing is that if you have a net, let's say, of
data structure,
mm-hmm. and one of them is persistent, the idea is that all of them are persistent.
That's some kind of thing. There are all of them.
Yeah, I mean, from the point of view of usability, I think that the best thing would be that, I mean, from the programmer's point of view, this thing, I want to be persistent. Whatever it holds, and whatever those holds, and whatever those other holds, all that is persistent. I think that that's the easier way how I picture that it would be a really
useful.
To use
That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, and we have sort of a starting point, right, which is the container.
The root structure.
So we say, okay, this root structure and everything that points to from this root structure and everything those point to make
that's
those
a purposes. Really complex thing to solve.
Yeah, I don't know if it's
going
to be solved.
I don't know.
That's an interesting problem.
I have one additional question.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case, if you go back... In your first example, let's say that you make L PMAL, or in L you do
the first one.
PMAL. Yeah,
the first
one.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest. So my question is because it seems like you have one first structure, and after that you can have pointers to some other structure, and you can have a change of pointers, right? So my question is, how do you retrieve the first one?
That's why we need use this
container
root structure. Yeah, the PC comp.
The container root structure contains
PCon,
the first one.
Okay.
Contains the pointers to every.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So the only thing that the restore returns is the pointer to the root.
Okay.
And as long as the programmer knows what's inside the root structure, you can access all the other things.
And actually, you can have many roots, right? It's not.
Yeah. If you have multiple containers. But the idea is to have one root per container.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree. I mean, if we can automatically figure out how to make all the discoverable data structures from the root persistent,
mm-hmm.
that could be a very valid use case.
Maybe
most programs will be written easily that way.
Yeah.
The challenge is how do you do
Yeah, because the idea is not to make this hard to use, it's to make it easy. I mean, like the transition from normal to this will be easy, should be easy.
Can we do that by just using pointer at information?
I'm not sure. I would have to think about it. I mean, I can't give you an answer.
So just using the root structure and the pointer information.
Yeah.
So we know where the pointers are. We start discovery based on information about the pointers. And all the pointers that start from a container
probably
also
we do,
are part of the container.
Yeah, probably we do a static analysis.
You know, I'm talking about dynamic.
Dynamically, it's very hard.
And static, you don't know because the these are heap memory, right? You don't know ahead of time how, where the heap memory is going to be allocated.
Yeah, but that's why I said you have to analyze the code.
No, no, that's why they told you preprocessor, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Or preprocessor.
Yeah, yeah. No, runtime, I don't think that you can do more.
Runtime?
Yeah, because at runtime you lose type information.
Not in C++ or C. In Java, you can.
Yeah, that's another question. This seems to be the language that you use needs to be fit in the sense that it's not, you cannot use, for instance, you cannot use this with C++ or something.
That's one of the future goals.
To make it
portable across languages.
Daniel is actually working on C++ related.
C++ is not a big change from C. For Chrome,
yeah.
I guess it would be a bigger change than C++.
Yeah, for other languages, I'm not sure because you would have to change how the data is stored.
No, in Java, everything is a polymorph.
Yeah,
but now that you say C++, I think there are some prongs.
Yeah, because in class you store some metadata.
In class you store some metadata like methods, pointers,
okay.
Which could change after you load the program. Right?
I'm not sure. We have just explored mostly C.
Yeah.
We have a whole bunch of pointers.
No, C++ is the list of methods,
No, that's the static location.
I mean, a class with many methods, it saves on memory the same way as a struct.
Oh, but the executable. I mean, it's part of the executable. So in the other space, it will be exactly the same. Oh.
Yeah,
because that's static.
Okay. So
static.
And the methods are linked to the type, not to the instance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I say it's static.
Pointers to methods. We don't consider that. Sorry? Pointers to methods.
We haven't talked about pointers in memory.
Or pointers to functions.
Yeah, pointers.
But I guess that doesn't have a problem because those are static locations.
Unless
you don't have to modify
the programmer modifies the code.
Yeah.
Unless the programmer modifies.
In that case, you could have some problems.
We actually expect
or recompile, yes, by recompiling different lines.
Well, but the original idea is for data that you are going to be putting time for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. I think you could have the case in which you want to store that point as a function, but the original idea is just for data, not for function.
I guess it's really good.
Yeah, but it's common in at least in C to have data structures with function more.
Yes, so I guess the question is how do we restore the function pointer?
Exactly, to the right location.
Well, it's not that common. It's just the kernel uses because it doesn't have options.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I'm thinking about the kernel.
Yeah,
I don't know user space.
No, but it's used as well. I mean, because in there you don't have like virtual fortress on the top of things, and not the way that you can like have dynamic fortress. I mean, I've seen it around. So.
Okay, I'm going to continue. Okay, so there are other challenges regarding how do we manage the storage part, storing the persistence points, right? So we want to make them first very very quick. Also, we want to make them atomic, so we want to have a transactional-like approach, right, similar to a database, and we want to make it scalable because we ideally want to have a whole bunch of containers probably loaded at a given point in time and load those all into Yeah, I mean, manage multiple containers at a time. So,
what do you mean by atomic persistent point?
So, that's simply either a persistent point goes through completely or doesn't go through, right? It's like a transaction.
I mean, you write the whole page or you don't write the
whole persistent point, or you don't write it. You don't want to have half a persistent point and not be able to restore from that, right? Okay. So
basic container, not page.
Yeah, container. Yeah, that's why I said persistent point. Okay. So here we also have a couple of ideas. And, I don't know if you guys want me to go into any of them. So, yeah, from a high-level point of view, historically what we're going to do is that, like I said, we're going to have pages, groups of pages, pulled together into chunks that are units bigger than a page, and those chunks are going to be written to disk as units. So we're going to write to the persistent medium, not to disk. In terms of in units of chunks. So and what we're going to optimize in the storage gate is how the layout of that chunk, right? So for hard disk, probably we have some characteristics, and let's say for SSD, what Louis was explaining, we probably want to make something like a logging, like a circular log and stuff like that, right? And the techniques for writing that vary depending on the type of piece. Okay.
So what you're saying is that writing atomically, you will do it differently depending on the persistent device.
The whole checkpoint needs to be atomic.
Mm-hmm.
That means that probably I don't want to overwrite something that previous information before the whole thing is completed.
Okay.
Right? That's what atomicity means in these terms.
And by transaction, you are committing several
parallel transactions.
No, several instructions. Several instructors at the
several pages. Several pages. Here you don't know anything about that structure. You know about pages that are dirty and pages that are clean.
Okay. No, so, because I'm thinking one way to do some kind of transaction is that you have two copies, right? And you write to them.
Yeah, so in that case you will need double the memory.
You will double the space in disk.
Yeah.
Right,
Write
ahead log. Doing some sort of a write ahead.
Right.
Yeah. That's one of the approaches, that you don't overwrite the complete thing, but eventually you have to reclaim space. So for instance, one of the things that we do is that since we're writing in bigger units, we try to, for the SSD, we try to write in the unit that the SSD typically writes, which is, I don't know, 1 megabyte, 2 megabytes, depending on the SSD. And by writing in that unit, we ensure that we're always writing a complete SSD block, right? So in that sense, I forgot where I was standing. So the point is that we're gonna need a little bit more memory, memory in the SSD than just store that. But it's not going to be double. It's just going to be a little bit more. Right?
I think the idea here of chunk remapping is addressing the performance issue. When writing atomically,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that may be worth discussing in comparing to a write-ahead log versus chunk remapping, because these are two very different ideas. That may be something that people may be interested in.
Okay, I have a little bit of that. Actually, I don't have that in the slides, but okay. So,
I mean, you could use the whiteboard.
Yeah. Okay, so, I can erase this, right?
Oh, my
everything.
So,
okay, so let's say this is my storage medium, and I have these two chunks, A and B, and I have space for three of them, right? So let's say, I write A here, and then B here, and then I write another transaction, and only A is 30, so I write A here, and mark this as 3, right? All right, so that's one of the cases. So the idea is that this guy has both a physical location on the process address space and a physical location on the persistent medium. And the physical location on the address space is gonna probably change every time it's loaded. But the physical location in the persistent medium is gonna change every time you write it. All right, that's why we have we call it chunk remapping.
Okay.
And yeah.
So I guess you don't make the previous one free until the first one is completely written.
Yes. Yeah. So in that sense, the idea is that ideally, let's say we allocate a container fits in this memory, and we use this in order to do that, the logging, right? The writing of the transaction. Right? Sorry, that's my question. Okay. So this is one of the parameters we're going to play with in our experimentation, this buffer here, how big it needs to be and all.
So you could sort of contrast this with the logging and checkpointing mechanism, right? What is the traditional mechanism for atomic transactions, and why is this different, and why is it making a different kind of trade-off for performing?
So the traditional approach is that you don't group first, you don't group into chunks. You just have individual pages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these pages you're gonna Okay, so these pages are smaller units, and at some point it's gonna be like you're gonna have some. Let me just look it up. Sorry.
Hello. Hello.
Okay. So when you have a smaller unit and you're writing in smaller units, what's going to happen is that eventually you're going to have some gaps, right? Let's say all this space is this space is used, then you have a hole there, then you have all this and here, right? So you're going to need to compact this in order to make space for another transaction, because you don't want to be skipping when you're writing. Right, so that's one of the ideas of cleaning when you have a log structure file system. Right, so you need to compact everything again.
And how about those holes? Why do those holes exist?
Because you wrote this page in another location when you were writing.
Oh, I see.
The new version, it always gets appended. And then this one is no longer the latest, so you just discard it as free. Right,
because
you're going to have those
part of an origin section.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right, so our idea was to use bigger units, and we're possibly, in some cases, we're going to be writing a lot more than we need to, probably, in this case, let's say only one page of touch. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going to be writing a lot more information, but at the end, we estimate that by doing this approach, the chunk way, we're going to be improving performance because of the cleaning. It's not that complicated, and then basically because the cleaning is we don't have to do it clean.
Okay.
right? That's always a very time-consuming and hard thing to do in log structure processing.
So do you have any special way of clustering pages? Like, do you cluster code pages?
No. Right now, the way that we're using it is just the way they get allocated.
Okay.
But that's something that we could probably use in the future. I mean, just storing pages that get used, that are co-located. I mean, that get dirty at the same time, we put them in the same chunk, and that sort of thing.
We had some ideas in that.
Right? Yeah, we had some ideas in that, but we're not implemented in it. Yeah.
Okay. I guess the reason you cannot do this is log structured file systems. Right? I guess the main reason is because in this case you have all the data in memory anyway. With log structured file systems, if you want to do something like that, you have to read all the missing pages first and create a chunk and then write it out. Here we don't need to do that. So that's sort of utilizing the available data in memory so we can do this.
Yeah, so actually, I'm just going to show some of the experiments. So, So, for instance, this is some basic experiment. We changed the size of the transaction, and here we on the y-axis, we measure the time it takes to do the transaction, right? So, log, this is the best case. This is if we have an infinite log that we can always write sequentially, right? This is on a hard disk. And true is our approach, and LCW is a log with cleaning.
Checkpoint.
Right? So we're here and they're here. And this is not implementable.
Yeah.
So we're good.
The number of operations is the number of pages in each chunk?
Yeah. The number of pages in the transaction.
So this is
simulated without the actual. No, this is actual. Yeah, this is actual page. Yeah.
And the workload.
The workload. If I remember correctly, those were random, touching random pages.
Okay.
Ensuring that you touch. Let's say here's 100 random pages, 200, and so on, random pages.
Okay.
Okay, so to summarize, the idea is that software persistent memory will simplify development of high-performance computing by giving an easy transaction to implement, also that the whole idea of persistence will be fully automated in the sense that you just have to do a persistent point and then a persistent restore and that would be it. And the checkpoints are performed very very quickly, quicker than doing a standard checkpoint. Right. Yeah, so some other applications that are beyond that. So this is for other talk. I'm not going to talk about this. I just want to say before I finish that we still have a whole bunch of things to explore in this project. We have probably 5% done. And before I used to be optimistic, now I'm being really pessimistic. So far we have only studied recoverability, but we have to study the whole execution, the whole replay and the execution branches, which could add significant complexities to this project. And we are already thinking of a whole bunch of extensions to this work, like the ones we mentioned here.
Yeah, I mean, some ideas are, what if you were building file systems? So you have data structure, file system metadata structures that you're allocating using persistent memory and you don't really have to worry about how to do journey anymore.
Yeah.
Anything of that sort, but you just create persistence points.
Yeah. That was one of the first applications that we thought of.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of persistent memory started because we were working on systems like Borg and Access, and these were all self-managing extensions, and they had these metadata structures that needed to be persistent, and that was becoming a pain, just to make these data structures persistent. That's where this started, and now it's becoming much bigger than that. And currently, we have a high-performance computing focus because that's what NSS gave us money for. That's how it works. But the good thing is that whatever we're doing for that, we can use it for the stuff that we are doing otherwise, it's self-managing storage. So if you build a storage optimization that needs persistent data, then maybe you can talk to George and see the status of this project, and perhaps you can actually use them for eventually.
I encourage you to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's all I have to say. Thank you. Nowhere else. Well, I was the last one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, Aria was supposed to do something, but he couldn't make it to that. Okay, great. So I guess we'll do this again in 2 months' time. But meanwhile, we'll have different things to talk about, I guess.
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully.
You can have a chat, yes.
So, ready one?